Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in public health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and...
It's the Media Project, your chance for some commentary, analysis, and even a little insight into the media issues of this very important week in the relationship between the press and our nation's 45th president.
Alan, who is that?
That's Rex, isn't it?
As you can hear, I'm not Rex Smith. In fact, I'm Mike Spain, the associate editor at the Times Union, filling in for Rex, who's my boss there. And I'm here with WAMC's president and CEO, columnist, commentator, professor emeritus, Dr. Alan Chartok. Hello, Alan.
Hello. When I'm here, when you're here in this studio, then I'm your boss, not Rex.
I don't think you signed my paycheck, sir. Anyways,
right.
And we also have Rosemary Armeo, head of the journalism program at the University of Albany. Welcome.
Thank you.
The big topic, of course, is the relationship between the news media and our 45th president. As he takes office, there's already some rumbling about how the Trump press officials are going to move where the White House press corps has been since, I guess, the McKinley administration. They've had credentials in the White House. And it's really seen as a way to bring in some of the alternative press that has been very favorable and contrary to the mainstream press, which has taken a beating. Is this really that big a deal, Rosemary?
Yes, it's a really big deal. And there are big problems coming our way, the press, from the Trump administration. We've seen that throughout the primary season and through the period of his president-elect status. They have backed away from the idea of moving the Corps out of the White House, but there will be new restrictions on who can hold the 49 seats, who can sit in the 49 seats, and who will get to ask questions. And clearly what they're going to is, you write about us favorably or you're not going to get any access. So my feeling is that the press should not wait to be treated this way. They should just see the writing on the wall and come up with a whole new plan for covering the White House. And that includes getting out of the White House. The press corps, when was the last story about the presidency or anything broken by the White House press corps? Going back to Watergate, it has not come from that group of people who sit inside and wait to be doled out press releases or short little appearances from the president. So get out. Go do our own work.
Dr. Chartok?
Well, as Rosemary knows, because we have duped this out many times, yes. I don't agree with her. I think what happens is, you know, your newspaper assigns you to one of those vaunted, valuable seats in the press briefings. And when you say, not one story, well, it depends. If it's a major, major story, maybe not. But you can get reactions to something that somebody else has broken or that one of your own people have broken, and you can't afford not to be there because you're just naive, as you know, and you're anything but naive, to believe, Rosemary, that somebody else, that your newspaper doesn't have to have a person at a press conference.
Jim Warren, a really very fine media writer about all things media, agrees with me, so of course I want to quote him. He's saying, instead of righteousness verging on groveling, why not make Trump and his courtesans like Spicer resemble the bullies they are, especially if they're picking dumb fights on the media's lodging. If they want to play white collar repo men, just simply and quietly agree. Go out. Don't come off as whining, privileged elite saving democracy from an emboldened president-elect. We tried that during the election period. Newspapers and other media outlets in this country came out strongly and strangely united. It almost was as if we are in cahoots and said he's terrible. Don't vote for him.
So let me get this straight, Rosemary, just because I'm not sure of your position. I'm not a big Trump fan, but I do want to know this. You've always felt that they should get out of the White House no matter who the president is, right?
Correct. I don't think it serves purpose to have, as you say, these are privileged positions. Some of the best reporters in the country are sitting in the White House waiting for somebody to come out and drop a press release on them. Get out and do some work.
Well, but
I feel the same way about the pool coverage, too, by the way, which is different than the White House press corps. The president traditionally, probably going back to since about McKinley, has had agreed to a 24/7 coverage, and not a horde of reporters, but a pool of a reporter and a photographer and probably a videographer are always in contact with the president. They always know where he is. It's essentially a death watch. It is, in case something happens to him. Trump has taken great delight in foiling this group of this pool reporter and gone off on his own. Let him. We don't need it anymore.
Okay. I get it. I think we all get it, and there's a position to be taken here. But I want to respond by saying Watergate breaks. Nixon gets up at a press conference if he does. Somebody's going to ask the first
question.
First question is going to be, what about that? Now, you can't tell me that that response isn't terribly important, or if a president is going to commute the sentence of Chelsea Manning. And everybody knew that would be the first question that was asked there. That's a terribly important response. You have to be there for that.
Right. That's what the role of the White House press corps is. It's to confront the president when they have the opportunity to do so, which hasn't been that often under the Obama administration. And just days before President Trump took office, President Obama held his final press conference where the issue of Chelsea Manning came up right away. And he had an opportunity to answer it, and he took questions on it. But his own record with the press has not been great. He's used alternative media to get around the White House press corps to reach different audiences. Presidents before him did that. Nixon went on Laugh-In to kind of bypass the regular Washington establishment. So it's not unusual. Donald Trump is taken to Twitter, and that's his way of combating. He told CNN that in the past week, that it's his way of combating what he says is bad media. So does it really matter anymore if the president isn't even answering questions or conducting things?
So you began by disagreeing with me, but you come around to exactly what I'm arguing, Mike, which is that the press conference is outmoded. We don't need it anymore. We saw it with Obama, who used Twitter, who went on YouTube shows, who went on cable shows and entertainment shows. Clinton did that too. I mean, this has been coming. So why are we hanging on to it? To make a point that Trump is not cooperating with
us? But as Alan says, it's a mechanism that's in place for when some big issue does happen. You have the opportunity to confront the president. It happened during Watergate. It happened during everything else.
Watergate was in the 70s. You guys are so out of date. There are other ways. There are other ways to confront the president. We have seen.
Well, how do you confront the president?
You stand in the lobby of Trump Hall and yell out a question to him, and he has consistently answered those questions.
Oh, he
calls up the New York Times in the middle of the night. He is not holding a whole ton of press conferences.
He only wants.
We've had one since July.
That's right. And here at WAMC, we're about to go into a fun drive, and nothing seems more important than what you're suggesting, Rosemary, which is that the First Amendment is under attack.
Definitely.
So we have both a mug, which we're giving away. This is a syndicated program, so I'm not giving telephone numbers or saying go to WAMC.org to get one. I'm just simply saying one says the First Amendment. We have the First Amendment printed on the cup, and on the other side it says now more than ever. Because it is now more than ever. If this country is going to go fascist, it's going to be because somebody cuts the legs off the press corps.
Well, let's just pivot. Let's just pivot to the final press conference of the of the Obama administration. And the very topic that we brought up is the commuting of the sentence of Chelsea Manning, who later this year will be released from jail after spending 7 years behind bars for releasing confidential and high-level security information to the media. Was it a courageous act on the part of the president, or as he is being criticized for, is it going to cause problems and only lead to more of these security leaks?
Alan knows my position on this. I've said it. I think Obama acted out of mercy. Chelsea Manning is a transgendered woman who has served almost 7 years in a men's prison, 2 suicide attempts, total misery. This was not an easy sentence. And all he did was release a person who was being tortured. We have a constitutional amendment, it's not the second, that says no cruel and unusual punishment. And that's plainly what her punishment had turned into. 35 years was her sentence. It was an extraordinarily long and out of character with all the other whistleblowing cases we've seen.
And let's remember, Rosemary and Mike, this president, Obama, has not been easy on leakers. He's been very tough.
The worst ever.
Really?
Yeah. No one has matched his record.
Well, the obvious next question is, if he has given a pardon to Chelsea Manning, doesn't he owe consideration to Edwin Snowden?
Now that, it's interesting. I want to hear Rosemary's take on it, which I always appreciated. But it's interesting that that comes from the New York Times.
And The Hill and a number of places.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so I've changed my view on this. I have evolved.
Me too.
If you had asked me this a month ago, I would have said, absolutely, I hope he...
He's a whistleblower and he should be celebrated.
And more than that, Snowden released documents far more important than what Chelsea Manning is being so horribly punished for. They revealed the NSA unconstitutionally was spying on its own citizens. That's something that the American people ought to know about, should know about. His revelations have sparked all kinds of debate and reform, and it's enormously important. However, since last month, and a movie came out, the Snowden movie by Oliver Stone, which made a big pitch for pardon for Snowden, too, was kind of distasteful.
Kind of an alternative approach to history,
yeah,
Oliver Stone.
Pure Oliver Stone.
Yeah, it just smudged all of the messy points. But now, you know, there is some intelligence and a report to the Senate suggesting that Snowden has been working with the Russians, who have given him asylum since he fled from the United States, fearing rightfully that he would be imprisoned or even executed for his revelations. In light of what the intelligence is also saying about interference in our election, I really think that needs to be further explored. So I am not in favor of a pardon for Edward Snowden at this time.
And the circumstances are very different. Edward Snowden is not in the United States. He has not pled guilty, and he is not saying, I did the wrong thing, all of which Chelsea Manning did, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a big difference. And he does seem to be, at least from where I'm sitting, to be potentially, I want to use that word, in cahoots with, I always slip, and I instead of saying Russians, I always say the Soviets. But this guy is right out of that Soviet model, Putin, you know, who was a KGB colonel. So I think these are very different circumstances.
Yeah, I'd make the point that both of these men, well, Chelsea was charged under, Snowden would be charged under the Espionage Act, which is a World War I law that was designed to stop people from giving information to our enemies. Neither talked to our enemies that we know of.
Well,
they gave
not directly, but
to
when
the
you
press.
Make information public, it does get viewed by all of our enemies.
Not the same, though. Yeah. Not quite the same. If a whistleblower can get the information, you have to assume a reporter could get it, too. That's not the same as giving information that's hidden and secret to an enemy. At any rate,
you've evolved. And guess what?
I have. Yeah, I want to hear more. And
if he really wants to be pardoned, he should return to the United States, face the charges, and have his case adjudicated. Then he'd have a request.
Okay, even Daniel Ellsberg, the leaker in the Watergate paper, says that would be crazy because they're out for blood. I mean, they want to go after the death penalty for him. So I'm not sure that I would come back in, too. But I would have my lawyer start negotiating a plea bargain. Mm-hmm. He definitely violated some laws, not the Espionage Act, but he signed a contract as a defense contractor, subcontractor, that he would not reveal information. So he plainly broke some laws. He should do some time. He should be willing to do some time. Instead, he wants a clear break. That's in disagreement with his pose up to now, as I did this for my fellow Americans and I'm a hero. So I'd
just like to say you're listening to The Media Project. With us today are Dr. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armijo, and I'm Mike Spain. Let's change topics here. We came through an election period where fact-checking became the common day practice by many large news media organizations, using research and facts to weigh whether statements made by various political candidates was accurate or whether it was inaccurate, whether it was a lie.
Isn't there one called Liar, Liar, Pants on Fire?
Right. That was PolitiFact would use that designation when a politician would make a completely false statement. What's going to happen? It doesn't seem that fact-checking changed the course of this election.
No. No, and we do know that Donald Trump could be, for want of a better word, a big fat liar. And nobody seemed to care or didn't seem to mean that much.
Well, the term fake news really moved to the forefront during the election. So if a candidate didn't like the assertion that he was making a misstatement, he could just say, well, that's fake news. And alternate versions of stories came out. And where does that leave the public? Letting them choose their own facts?
I don't like the whole idea of fact checking. I don't know how it got separated from reporting. And what we saw in this last election was that fact-checking became like an attack on whatever candidate you were fact-checking. Like, she lied there. He's wrong there. This is a misleading thing. It felt like an attack. The truth and checking facts should be part and parcel with context and background and what the person was talking about when they made the statement that you're contesting.
But wasn't that really what happened? They would put in the context and the background and explain. And often they said, you know, it's mostly true or it's partially true or it's not true at all. And they would explain it quite in depth. That was my experience.
It was in separate articles or separate,
Right. It wasn't part of an article. It was like a Q&A or
it was a
different format.
It was like, we think you're a liar. We're going to check every word you said. I hate that as a person.
Well, but wait. But isn't there such a thing as resources? I read an article, I think in the Times, talking about how they were going to change what they were doing. They were going to get rid of a lot of the editors. There were going to be different levels of editors, meaning that they wouldn't have the people to do exactly what you're saying, Rosemary. And I take it you would bemoan that loss, right?
Absolutely. I think you saw what happened. We now have a president whose spokesman said, well, there's no such thing as facts anymore. People can say what they think is true, but I can think something different. And that's that whole idea that I can believe climate change is not real. And that's the same as the scientist over there who's done years of research and has the data to back up the fact that it is real. You can't equate opinions or partisan feelings with facts. And we've gotten that all mixed up.
So, right, going forward, what should the news media, what do you recommend that journalists do to deal with these inconsistencies and these various versions of what's out there?
Well, first of all, Rosemary and I are in disagreement once again. Even though I have nothing but the ultimate respect for her, she's been a lifelong journalist in a way that I haven't. Even though I did run the Fire Island newspaper all those years ago.
And
the
only we had a bet that he could get Fire Island and he could get it into any conversation.
Nevertheless, I really think if the newspapers aren't going to do it, and if that's a fact of life, then somebody's got to do it. And Nature Abhors a Vacuum, I love the idea that there's a PolitiFact or any of those groups out there saying, you're a big fat liar.
I've been thinking a lot about this. I think the press corps and the press in general needs a whole reset and figure out what to do. Now is the time to say, okay, we're in the 21st century. We have a very virulently anti-press administration that we have to deal with. What are we going to do? And complete reset. That means give up the press corps and the pool coverage. Do not whine about it. It makes no difference. Assign people to stories that actually matter.
One rather than the other. In other words,
because of resources. We don't have the resources to do both.
But we don't have the
it's
resources.
It's happening at a time when the news media is in an enormous turmoil and the economic model that has supported it for a century or more is at peril.
It reminds me of being in the kindergarten. Everybody had to draw a picture and you weren't a very good artist, meaning me. I wasn't a very good artist. And then you would take black and you would go over the whole thing. And Rosemary, that's what you're calling for. This thing.
You didn't even hear what I was calling for yet.
I'm sorry, I did miss that connection.
Yeah, I'm writing black all over everything because I said get rid of.
You're looking for another new fresh piece of paper, I think.
I want the media to work together in ways that we have not seen formerly. I don't mean on stories, but when CNN asks a question and Trump shouts them down, the Fox News reporter has to get up and ask that question. It's the media confronting the president and holding him accountable.
I think that went on for every previous president, where presidents have been hammered by reporters from various different news organizations.
I think we certainly saw it in Donald Trump's last news conference as a pre-election president, where people did get up and do that. But Rosemary,
I guess that was unusual and good, and the step that should become common.
Well, you train young journalists,
yes.
Rosemary.
Yes, you do.
And Alan, you speak to young journalists and want to be journalists all the time. I mean, what advice do you give a person going into the business now about how to approach their profession and their craft?
Well, you know, I've trained because I ran the Legislative Gazette newspaper all these years, and I know that the people who become the stars have one quality, and that is guts. They really have guts. The nicest people in the world aren't always the best journalists. You've all certainly seen that. But you have to have courage and to stand up and to basically, rather than use this in a negative way, spit in the eye of power.
Well, it's actually the editors and the media owners who have to have the courage, because I can turn out any number of hard-hitting stories, but if they don't get printed, I have no power. So courage comes from editors and owners. And we see models of how to do it. David Fahrenthold of the Washington Post did it right, and he is a nice guy.
During the presidential election, he followed the money, essentially. He looked at Trump's business relationships and his taxes and, you know, was leading the way. And others quoted him frequently. I mean, he really led the way.
He engaged people saying, look, I'm looking into how much money Trump actually gives charity versus what he says he's given it to. So if you've been a beneficiary, call me. And he didn't hear from anybody, and he went out looking for him.
And he did, and he did have an editor and a publisher and an owner.
Marty Behrens in the Washington Post,
right,
Jeff Bezos.
Who basically said it's okay to do that.
Yep.
Right. But another thing he did was he was scrupulously accurate. Accuracy, of course, is always the number one goal of journalism, but we cannot make mistakes. The Washington Post, again, we praise him so I can hit him, ran a story about fake news and used a news site that was itself fake. They hadn't vetted their own story. It wasn't malicious. It was a stupid error. And Glenn Greenwald, who is an investigative reporter who believes that the media as a big institution also should be investigated, exposed it. That's the sort of thing that makes it look like we are out to hurt Trump.
And remember,
can't do that.
And remember, Watergate, of course, you know this all too well, Rosemary, and lecture your students on it, but Nixon's people found one mistake and wrote it, they thought, all the way to victory, they thought.
Right. When Woodward and Bernstein made an error and they made an assumption and had an incorrect story that they had to walk back, the White House went ballistic on it and used that to discredit everything else they do. And that's always been a problem. A reporter makes a mistake. So you say you need bullies, you need people with guts, Alan, but Rosemary says you need people who are accurate. Getting a combination of that is not
that easy.
Yeah.
It is really hard. And the other thing I think you're going to see is an onslaught against the press on libel. And Trump has said repeatedly, this is no secret, he wants to loosen the libel laws. And the way he's going to do this, working with Peter Thiel of PayPal, is to spend a lot of money going after reporters and journalists in every venue. Every time there's something they object to.
Even if the reporter has the law behind them and they're protected by the law, the cost of fighting these legal battles will bankrupt them. And the fear of that will basically stifle reporters from being gutsy. And that's the fear that's going to happen. Let me just completely switch gears here because, Alan, you have had a career that has been around supporting FM radio, public radio over FM. Well, it seems to be going the way that television is going, and more people are getting their information digitally. And I'm citing a story by Bloomberg News that says in Norway, more people are getting radio, essentially, over their smartphones or by computer. And the traditional way of broadcasting news over the air is going by the wayside. How is that going to affect public radio?
Well, it's going to affect us because either we have to get on board or we're going to lose. And in fact, we're doing all of that. We have a tremendous operation going here at this radio station so that anybody can get anything at any time. Any of our programs is available to them. This program is available.
As a podcast?
As a podcast all the time. So you're absolutely right about that. On the other hand, as we old people, because I come in very early in the morning, every morning. I turn on the BBC because it's on our station very early, and I listen all the way in, seriatim, as we say, one after another. Just the old way of doing things. But what will happen is the people like me will disappear. And then nobody will get in a car without saying, I think I'll hear the Media Project this morning, or I think I'll hear this or that. It'll make a big difference. If we don't go with that flow, we will be lost.
Well, just as a final note, the New York Times is in the midst of change, and they are now in the process of reevaluating their position. A couple of years ago, they put out a report that set the course for its future, and now they're kind of revising that, and it's a little more optimistic. It's saying that the future depends on their ability to engage with their audience. Is that news? Surprise?
Well, I think it's huge. And I also think the one thing, I read that story very carefully. I know you guys always accuse me of not reading material, but I read that story very carefully. And the one thing I was thinking, and I'm a big fan of the Times, I read it constantly, is that the ethics of the Times need to be adhered to, meaning that, you know, they can't have enemies who they don't want to quote because they don't like them and that kind of thing. If you're going to have this interaction with your audience, then you really have to be open and transparent and fair.
Have they been?
Well, I think there are some exceptions to what I think have followed that model as a whole. I think it's the best newspaper in the world. As I say, I read it three times during the night, every night. It has put tremendous resources on. But they're also saying, as that part of that model, Mike, that they can't sustain the number of editors and checkers and everybody else that they've had up until now. And that's going to change the nature of the Times.
There's a story in the New York Times this week that I read, and it has to do with where colleges in the United States draw their students from, the upper 1% or the bottom 1% or so. And it's all done in this visual first, very digital, new agey way. And I can't understand it. I don't see visually. I am such a dinosaur, so out of the...
So wedded to the printed word?
Yeah. You know, and the idea that an editor doesn't do much, it just changes some words around, just posts the story, it doesn't matter, which is part of this report. It hurts me, and I worry that I'm teaching young journalists because I don't think that's what's wanted anymore. I mourn the past.
But isn't it only how you tell the story? The story still has to be based on facts. It has to be smart. Yeah. It has to have context, et cetera.
Okay, that's really nice to say it, but I read this story and I did not understand it.
Well, on that note,
I know what you mean, Rosemary.
You've been listening to The Media Project. I'm Mike Spain, filling in for Times Union editor Rex Smith, and we have Rosemary Armeo and Alan Chartok. Thank you.
Hey, Mikey, thanks for doing this.
Let's give preachers the freedom of the press.